spoken word.
A taste of Melbourne's diverse poetry scene.
Poets using their voices to entertain, to move, to take you on a journey.
Connecting you to grassroots poetry and performance.
Good morning, I'm Tina Janukas. Welcome to Spoken Word on 3CR. 3CR broadcasts from the lands of the Wurundjeri of the Kulin Nation. I pay my respects to elders past and present. Today on the program, I'm joined by poet and publisher Mark Roberts, who is no stranger to 3CR's spoken word listeners. For over four decades, Mark has been active in writing, criticism and publishing. In 1982, he co-founded the long-running magazine P76. In 2011, he and his partner Linda Adair launched the online journal Rochford Street Review. Mark has just released his third poetry collection, The Office of Literary Endeavours, with Five Islands Press. And I'm delighted to welcome him back on the show today.
Thank you, Tina.
It's nice to have you back. You were on the show not so long ago talking about your pathway in poetry. And today we're going to talk about your new collection, The Office of Literary Endeavours. There are three poems in the collection with that title. Could you read the opening poem of the collection and tell us about these rather quizzical poems that I think give the collection a marvellously wry touch?
Okay, I'll start by reading the first of the three poems titled The Office of Literary Endeavours. This is the first one that was written, so good call out. The Office of Literary Endeavours 1, Part 1. Before beginning her poem, Marie set out to walk across the mountains to the Office of Literary Endeavours. Unfortunately, as she crossed a crumbling bridge, she slipped and fell into the valley. Her death went unnoticed, except for a small bird and an old tree who remembered her poem and recited it softly to any traveller who passed by. Part 2. Marie had been mumbling her poem when she slipped on a loose stone and toppled off the bridge. As she fell, she began to shout the words, feeling them whipped from her mouth before they were formed. The poem was all through her as she lay amongst the stones at the bottom of the valley. Her mind flashed the colour of her words a final time, brilliant colours that dispersed into a sunset. The poem remained etched in her bones as her skin fell away. The words in her fingers, toes, belly and heart dissolved into the earth. A bird pecking at her eye removed a phrase. The wind blew away the dust of letters.
It's got a wonderful quality about it, that poem. It draws me in. What's going on there?
It's interesting because the character of Marie is actually from a long prose sequence I'm trying to write. I've been trying to write for a number of years. I have the idea it could be a novel. Marie is one of the characters in that. And in that piece of writing, she isn't actually a writer. She's a filmmaker. There's another character who's the writer. The Office of Literary Endeavours is a more or less an imagined space, a place that artists strive to get to. So it can be different things to different people, but obviously it's not easy to get to. In the final poem, that is also Marie leaving Rome, flying to a place where she's trying to get to the Office of Literary Endeavours. And once again, that's very much in my mind for the prose sequence of a city somewhere that's under siege, and inside is the Office of Literary Endeavours. It's a safe place, somewhere where the sanctuary, but it's also somewhere where art is created.
You have three of these poems interspersed through the collection.
Look, they do bookend the collection. That the second poem sits, you know, almost in the middle. So there is a view of it holding the structure together. So, yeah, it's that sort of idea of striving, how art is created, that I think I've built the rest of the collection around. There is another poem, I think it's called Subsidence, which is also coming from that same place, that same prose piece, and that is about another safe place being flooded by climate change. So a meeting place for artists that is on the shoreline, and the seas were slowly rising and flooding it. So that's the sort of metaphor that's sort of running through the thinking for the prose piece. And I think there's times when those prose characters escape into poetry.
One of the things that I find very interesting about the collection, and essentially about your work, is that I actually have a sense of a poet who's been subtly evolving over the years. finding especially a voice that can speak candidly, even movingly, of several issues, including one that runs through the book, which is Irish dispossession. I would like you to read one of these poems and tell 3CR listeners how you came to explore these themes and how they resonate for you in the Australian context generations later, after your Irish ancestors migrated or were forced to come to Australia.
Yes, it's interesting because my mother's side of the family is the Irish Catholic side. There was always a sense of Irishness on my mother's parents, particularly my grandfather. His mother was born in Ireland. Many of my ancestors came from Ireland. And even on my father's side, which was always supposedly the English side, I've discovered Irish convicts, Irish famine girls being brought out to the colony and wedded off. That's sort of like a theme that as I've gone deeper, I've sort of found those connections. In 2016, I actually went back to Ireland for a couple of days. And interestingly, that was the first time anybody from my family in three generations has actually gone back to Ireland. There was a sense of, yes, there's a deep connection here to both the land and the people we were talking to. So, interesting.
Well, let's have a poem.
Okay. I guess the poem that jumps out is Returns. This is about returning to Ireland. The reference to leaving Melbourne is interesting because in order to get the fly, we had to fly from Sydney to Melbourne, so we actually flew out of Melbourne. So even though I'm a New South Wales-based poet, there's that Melbourne reference in the first part of the poem. Returns. One, hidden. Leaving Melbourne, flying northwest across desert. Below, darkness, scattered lights. Even in daylight, stories are hidden here. At night, they call to us, singing across country, reaching into the sky. In this plane we eat, watch a movie, try to sleep. 2. Yellow sea chest. As per airline instructions, we have each packed 2 bags to travel 30 hours to Dublin. We have left behind my great-grandmother's sea chest, which contained all her possessions when she travelled to Sydney 150 years ago. She had luggage restrictions as well. One sea chest for everything she wanted to keep for a new life away from hunger and the English. The sea chest had secret compartments and pictures from the 1860s varnished onto the boards. The leather straps have rotted away, and my grandfather painted it yellow during the Depression, a bright colour to cheer things up. The curved top of the chest meant that it had to be stacked on top of the pile of cases in the hold and indicated that my great-grandmother had a little more social standing than most. 3. Leaving Roscommon, Strokestown Park, and Gotter Moor. We drive out through the gates, the chill in our bones, a reminder of a history that follows us down these short country roads. A land that tugs at memory. My grandfather's stories of why the English can't be trusted, exporting grain while his grandparents starved, his mother hung by a hair from a roof beam. These things are hard to forget, even across generations. 4. Dublin GPO. Along with the saints, my grandfather taught me the names of the martyrs. Patrick Pearse, Thomas Madeau, Thomas Clark, Joseph Plunkett, William Pearse, Edward Daly, Michael O'Hanrahan, John McBride, Eamon Sennett, Michael Mallon, Shane Houston, Colin Colbert, James Connolly, Sean Dimarama. He had just turned 16 when the Easter Uprising erupted on the other side of the world. 50 years later, he still held that anger. He told me they had to rope Connolly to a chair in front of the firing squad because his ankle had been shattered by a bullet in the GPO. My grandfather never saw Ireland, but today I silently tell him there's no Union Jack flying on Dublin GPO.
That's actually one of my favourite poems in the collection. I find that a very moving poem. What I'd like to explore with you is something that I think we don't often think about, or maybe we do. Here you are, several generations later, and yet you are, in essence, re-experiencing the trauma of the colonisation of Ireland and weaving that trauma into the poetry. How do you actually filter that through in your mind?
It's interesting because being brought up Australian in a country where, you know, when I went to a primary school, we still sang God Save the Queen as our national anthem. So I'm old enough to remember that period before we actually got our own national anthem. And of course, the Union Jack's still in the corner of our flag. So there's that connection back to England. The learning, the education that we received is very English-based. Going to university, we learned the canon, you know, the classics of English literature. Poets like Yeats, you know, cut through that. You know, Easter 1916 was a bit of a revelation and started making the connections back with my own family, some of the things that my grandfather had said. Even though he was no longer there, you know, memories came up. When we cleaned out his library, for example, his office, we found an IRA songbook. Finding that IRA songbook was actually quite interesting because that songbook dates back to the Troubles in Belfast, and my grandfather obviously was very firmly on the side of Irish nationalism. And that's sort of something that has run through me, you know, since I've made all those connections. The first time we actually travelled to Ireland was in 2016. We were there to sort of see all the celebrations of the centenary of the 1916 uprising and, you know, the bullet holes still in the GPO, in the various buildings around St. Stephen's Green where the trenches were built. Yeah, it's a very interesting period in Irish history. It impacted the Irish in Australia to a very large extent, and I think it's still running through a lot of Irish Australians now.
The collection also reflects on place and belonging, and especially in the context of Indigenous and non-Indigenous relationship to country. In a poem like Cargo Road, I sense a deep awareness of that tension. Could you read it and speak to how you navigate this tension between Indigenous and non-Indigenous belonging?
Mm. Look, I am working on a longer sequence of poems around spending a lot of time as a young boy, teenager, around Orange in sort of central west New South Wales. And that's because my father's aunts and uncles lived on a farm on Cargo Road. And part of that is, once again, memory, thinking back to their life, how they related to the farm and the society around them, but also the gaps. There's lots of gaps in their history. They actually came from Devon in about 1912 as children with their parents and established a farm on Cargo Road. But that whole area is very interesting in terms of the history because of Mount Conobolus, which is the Western name for that mountain, and the discovery of gold in the area. So a lot of the Aboriginal culture, the Indigenous culture, has actually been stripped from the top layers of the soil during the gold rush. The Wiradjuri, the people who lived in that area, fought the Bathurst Wars to try and stop the spread of settlement across the mountains. So there's my personal history. There's a hidden history of place as well. So what don't we know about the history of that area? That comes together in Cargo Road a little bit, which I've written from the point of view of my great uncle, who was a farmer called Tom Rice. Now, I'm not sure whether Tom actually thought this, but I'm stepping into his shoes a little bit here to sort of imagine him thinking about his place in this country and on the farm. Cargo Road is actually a road that runs from Orange to Cargo. As a child, it was a dirt track. Now it's bitumen, but there you go. Cargo Road. Morning snow drifts down Gunnambulla. I watch from the veranda as dark clouds hide the mountain, the snow line reaching towards the road. Flurries drift on the breeze. In the bottom paddock, cows move, small clouds of breath. There will be tea inside soon, and wood to bring in. And this afternoon, a drive to the pub. 50 years on this land means I know the way the weather approaches around the mountain, how to read the wind, clouds and sunsets. But the dirt still escapes me. My mother and father are the only family buried here on the hill in the town cemetery, far away from my sister and ancestors resting in English soil. Do we need to know the dirt to lie in it, to dissolve into it? How long does it take to belong? So I guess that is sort of like a question about, you know, belonging, moving. You know, these people lived for centuries in one place. That sudden movement, the Industrial Revolution, I guess, the changing international sort of situations and things, just, you know, moving people across the world.
And yet it brings them to Australia and that results in the dispossession of a whole other people. Mm. And it's an uncomfortable thing to deal with. So I find that line, the poem, that says, how long does it take to...
How long does it take to belong?
That's right. Mm. I find that a very double-edged question.
Yeah. What does it mean to be Australian, to sort of, you know, live in Australia, to walk on country, on somebody else's country, even though it has a name, Australia, that somebody has given to the entire continent? You know, underneath the concrete, there's still the country that was there before.
I think 3CR is the voice of the people, speaking back to the establishment and telling them what they think, and sometimes it's something they don't want to hear.
Welcome back. I'm Tina Janoukas. You're listening to Spoken Word on 3CR. Today, I'm speaking with poet and publisher Mark Roberts about his new collection of poetry, The Office of Literary Endeavours, published by Five Islands Press. Now, Mark, one of the things that strikes me about The Office of Literary Endeavours is your tonal range. There's sort of wry amusement, puzzled observation, even a sense of the absurd. Yet the poems convey an emotional depth without losing that lightness of touch in the language. You're not heavy-handed with what you're trying to say. I'd say, actually, that you're quite a poet of feeling in some ways. So is it something that you consciously cultivate, or does it come naturally to you?
Interesting question. I work on poems a lot. So a lot of these poems have gone through many drafts, so different versions where the voice hasn't worked, or there's a part of the poem that grates or doesn't meld with the rest of the poem. Sometimes you only notice that by leaving it and coming back to it and workshopping it. I'm involved in a writer's group that meets in Sydney monthly, and a lot of the poems have been through that writer's group. Getting feedback from other people around the sound, the words you're using. And, you know, sometimes it may just be one word where you know, people are questioning, does that word work? And even if they can't suggest the right word, you go away and spend time thinking about how to make that work. And you may end up, you know, changing the entire line or the stanza because of that one word that sort of leaps out. So there is that sense of a lot of work going into these poems and a lot of thought. In terms of the feeling, I guess that's something I'd like to think that comes out of these poems. Sometimes it's difficult to put yourself in the position of somebody else reading them because a lot of them are personal. They're reaching back into memory. You're playing around with things that may work for you. Hopefully they resonate with other people as well.
But I'm also struck by the formal clarity of the poems, the way they remain open and accessible, but they're holding very complex ideas beneath their surface. Could you read a poem and speak to how that kind of formal clarity comes to the service of your work beyond workshopping or doing drafts and redrafts?
Mm. There are a number of poems about the Blue Mountains, Darugan Gundungurra country, where Linda and I live now. The Blue Mountains is an interesting place to live because it is still wilderness. It's part of World Heritage Area, and there's a road and a train line that runs along the plateau, and the villages cling to that. So there is a sense that we're surrounded by something else, so it's very easy to disappear into that wilderness, into the bush. This poem is called A Narrow Ridge. Cockatoos pierce the valley, fly through a rainbow, flashes of white against dark clouds threatening snow. They gather on trees, call to each other about trains returning after the flood and how there are green shoots among the ash in the hills. They leave us to this thin line clinging to the highway. The deeper they fly into this burnt landscape, the safer they are. Now their songs only reach us during cold nights when the wind blows from the escarpment. So obviously this poem is written after the 2019-2020 bushfires, which were quite scary. We could see the fires from our house moving towards the town. It was a reminder that we are just clinging to this space.
Actually, when I read that poem, I made a note in my book and I said, again, what holds against the silence? Because it seems to me that your poems... there's a silence in them that you're speaking. You're kind of drawing out what is in that silence.
Mm. The birds are really interesting because there's so many different birds around the mountains. The cockatoos are obviously sort of quite prominent, but the migration of birds backwards and forwards. If people remember the Rio Tinto destroying the Aboriginal cultural caves in Western Australia years ago, I was thinking about that a lot and how that rippled across the country or cross country. So not just the fact that it happened, but the impact it had on the songlines, the way we relate to where we live. I saw the birds as bringing that message from the West through the rest of the country. There's a piece of that there, that they retreat into areas we can't go. And, you know, if we listen, there's sounds there that we can actually learn from. But very rarely do, you know, settlers such as us have that sort of ability to listen to those sounds.
Or the patience.
Or the patience, yes. Mm. Yeah. And I think, you know, poetry is one way of doing that because it does slow everything down. So once again, this poem went through lots of different versions. So 2 or 3 years after the event, the poem emerges. But that listening to the inner voice, trying to make things, you know, the lines work, the words work on a page, there's that patience, that listening, that means you're not only focusing on the page, but you're also listening to, you know, everything around you.
I'm wondering about all of this, you know, Mark, as I've been listening to you speak about your work. I did say earlier that there's a sense of a poet subtly evolving, and I have that very strong reaction to your work, that this is a poet that has been thinking about these things, churning them over. I'm just wondering, really, how you have been relating to the issues of the day as a poet.
Mm. An interesting question, because there's so much to relate to. I guess the stuff that's happening in Australia, the discussions around, you know, voice, treaty, truth, the impact of the failure of the referendum, the questions around the Uluru Statement from the Heart, and, you know, even going, you know, back further, both Linda and I were active in the calls for a Royal Commission to Black Deaths in Custody decades ago. And one of the tragedies is those recommendations were never implemented, and we're seeing the deaths just piling up. And it's a failure of culture. It's a failure of understanding our place in country that these things are continuing. But then we spread out further into what's happening in the US with Trump, with the situation in the Ukraine and the Middle East, and, you know, again and again, that there's that colonization question around how people relate to the land they're living on, where they've moved to, the people who are living there previously. If we can solve that, I think we probably would be on our way to solving world peace.
Would you like to read a poem that somehow speaks to that?
Look, I'll read Armistice Day 2023. This is the second time I've actually examined the notion of Armistice Day, so the day that commemorates the ending of the First World War in poetry. Decades ago, I was reading Virginia Woolf's diary and the entries for October, November 1918. Virginia Woolf's diaries are quite beautiful. They're very poetic. Virtually every entry is a prose poem. It was actually quite easy to take some of those entries and build a poem out of them. And one of them was actually her diary entry for November the 11th, 1918. That was in my previous collection, Concrete Flamingos. It does actually sort of have a bit of a counterweight to this Armistice Day poem, because that was looking at the ending of a conflict, and a conflict that was touted as the war to end all wars. And in reality, even on November the 11th, 1918, there was conflict happening in Ireland, there was conflict happening in Russia, there was still conflict in Africa and Asia. This poem, I guess, is looking back from today at the history that stretches between a modern Armistice Day, November the 11th, now, and 1918. It starts with a quote from W.H. Auden from his poem, The 1st of September, 1939, which obviously is another poem that is driven by conflict in the beginning of World War II. The quote goes, "I and the public know what all school children learn. Those to whom evil is done do evil in return." Armistice Day, 2023. Over a century ago, some guns fell silent, but the percussive melody of bullet and shell remained a soundtrack for generations who went from newsprint to radio broadcasts and television images to the tenuous reality of social media. A redrawing of colonial lines on a map, a harrowing evolution from direct rule to spheres of influence marked by an exponential growth in unmarked graves. We remember a history, the bullet to the head, the child buried in the rubble of a building, the slit throat, bodies swinging from a tree. Meanwhile, we rushed towards the station, anxious to make the train home, giving the man in a dirty sleeping bag, sheltering in the pedestrian tunnel, a wide berth. Then on Friday night, gathered on the rooftop bar, we watched the pretty explosions of fireworks and listened to the dogs barking in the street below.
I really like that poem.
It's one of my favourites because it does actually bring together a lot of my concerns about what's happening in the world, but it also manages, I think, to sort of look at what's happened from 1918, the redrawing of colonial lines on a map.
Several poems also engage with what I suspect, or I gather, is something that you enjoy a great deal, which is film. One of the poems that I really like is Final Reel. You know, would you like to read that poem and tell us a little bit about what draws you to respond to cinema through poetry?
Look, I've always been interested in film, storytelling, narrative, bringing words and images together. I think in some of these film poems, sort of responding to an art form. And look, I particularly like a lot of Goddard's work. There's some of the movies he made in the late 60s, you know, handheld cameras in the streets of Paris. They're immediate. They're capturing a history, a lot of political theory behind them, but also they're quite visually beautiful. Final Reel, After Breathless, directed by Jean-Luc Godard, 1960. I know it's a trap, but I'm in love, and this is how I should want it to end. Though when I saw the police car at the end of the street, I ran. There's only so much film left, and if it doesn't end in a kiss, it will end in tears, and they won't be mine. I run hard for the street corner, for the shelter of concrete. The first bullet whistles past me. I'm filled with elation. The second bullet hits my left shoulder, spinning me around. I keep running. I see the garbage bins ahead as the music surges. More bullets, and I'm dancing, staggering into an embrace of rubbish. I hear a clarinet, feel your tears, and sense the end credits.
It's kind of like the ekphrastic poem, in a way. Could you read a final poem, perhaps one that resonates with the mood of the collection?
It's interesting because when Les Wicks launched this collection in Glebe in May, he made the point the poems are actually quite violent, but that violence is not apparent until you actually understand what the poems are about. The tone is not violent. Then looking at them going, actually, yes, there is a lot in here that can be seen as potentially violent, but it's a violence that is part of the lived experience. I think I'll end with a poem called Sediment. This is a poem that I haven't actually read in public, but I do think it actually illustrates some of the points that you've been referring to, Tina. Sediment. Sky reflects country. Water reflects sky. We have watched ice, embers, dust float onto soil. Reading winds and currents. History layering onto a recent garden. Hard to sense connections, buried by guns and imported gods.
Thank you, Mark. It's been wonderful talking about this new collection of yours, the Office of Literary Endeavours, and congratulations.
Thank you, Tina.
I'm Tina Janoukas, and you've been listening to Spoken Word on 3CR. Today, I've been speaking with poet and publisher Mark Roberts about his latest collection of poetry, The Office of Literary Endeavours, published by Five Islands Press. Spoken Word broadcasts every Thursday on 855 AM at 9 AM, or you can download the podcast. Thank you for listening.